Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is your new Comics Wednesday episode for October 28th, 2020. And as much as I hate to do it, I have got to give a shout out to the Dodgers for winning the World Series of 2020. I don't know if they won so much as the Rays gave it to them, but for what it's worth, their first World Series in 32 years. Hey, if the Rangers had won, I'd be celebrating it. So,
there's things about the Dodgers I can't say on here. So
it is what it
nope.
is. So.
Nope. You know what? I want to go ahead and give proper congratulations to Brian Edward Hill, who is going to be writing the next Power Rangers film, which for me is very exciting.
Yeah, did you hit him up yet for
not yet. I said congratulations. I'm pretty sure he's being hit up left and right, but
oh yeah, that's probably true.
I put it up on LRM and then I messaged him and he said thanks. So
right on.
Well, there's a ton
of books this week.
Well, that's an understatement.
We may be setting a record for most books talked about in a new comic book day episode. So let's get started. We'll try to keep them kind of short. What do you have up first, Manny?
You know what? Let's start off with Suicide Squad 10. This one is written by Tom Taylor with art by Bruno Redondo, colors by Adriano Lucas. And I thought this was going to be the end. I'm guessing I'm wrong. I should probably follow previews in books like that because they tend to tell you when stories are going to
end. I think there's one more. I think it goes to 11.
So yeah, it goes to 11. We've pretty much found out that Ted Kord is not the one behind it, which makes absolute perfect sense. And it is in fact another villain who has been the mastermind out of trying to manipulate the Suicide Squad to do his bidding. Unfortunately, now there is a certain young lady who is ready to explode, so the Suicide Squad have to deal with that. They are also dealing with the fact that Deadshot is dead, supposedly. You know how in comics it goes. But I'm being very vague with it because I'd rather you read it and enjoy it for what it is. It is definitely of the style of Suicide Squad, and I like the twist. I like the character that they chose to be the mastermind behind all of the shenanigans, and I'm very happy with it. Just because of the fact that it's satisfying. It wasn't something dumb. It wasn't something that felt forced, and it's a character we hadn't seen in a while. So very good. One of my favorite lines in the book though is Harley Quinn goes, "Ted Kord's not Batman," and then he goes, "What kind of a billionaire would spend their time being a vigilante in Gotham?" And he's like, "Yeah." And then Harley's like, "Yeah, he would have to have some major problems." That was a great laughing moment. Art's really meh. Like, it's not great. It's not bad. It's just there. Very, very bright colors in the book, which I appreciate. Very clean. There's not much else to say about it. I'm really looking forward to seeing how this ends up in issue 11, which to me, weird number to end on, by the way.
Yeah, I mean, it all comes down to, 5G probably supposed to start and then didn't, and so they probably went to Tom and said, "Hey, if we gave you a few more issues," because remember, not too long back, there was a kind of a one-of issue that was like really different than the story was going, where it had like origin of a couple people.
Uh-huh.
So maybe they inserted that one, and that's how they got to 11. I mean, who knows? So we could speculate, but it would just be that speculation. Let me go ahead and talk about my first book. It is from Aftershock, one of our favorite smaller publishers. It's called Sympathy for No Devils. It's issue number one. It's written and co-created by Brandon Thomas. Lee Ferguson handles the art and is co-creator. We have Jose Villarubia on colors and Simon Boland on letters. So it's not really explained in the issue itself unless you read the back matter, which there's some police reports and case review kind of thing that gives some more information. But basically what's happened is the world is a very different place than what it is outside our window now. And it's telling the story of Winston Wallace, who's literally the last human on Earth. Everybody else is like a zombie or a monster or a ghoul or an alien or just some kind of weird type creature. And Winston has this ability, this incredible luck that keeps him alive in dangerous situations. But he doesn't necessarily want to be. I mean, it's not really that much fun for him to be sort of the last human. You know, he feels like he'd be better off just being able to rest in peace, as it were. And so throughout the course of the story, we learn that he used to be on the police force. Now he's a private detective. And he's really just trying to get along in the world and maybe hoping that someday his luck will run out and he won't keep having these incredible accidents happen that keep him alive in this kind of ghoulish world that he lives in. So that's kind of the premise of the story. The art's pretty solid. The colors are, you know, sufficiently moody for a story that's set in this type of setting where, you know, it's a lot of underworld. So you get a lot of blues and purples and darker shades, but the palette itself is pretty bright. So it's not a morose type story. And I wouldn't categorize it as horror so much as kind of fantasy mixed with some sort of hard boiled detective, you know, a lot of tropes. We get through sort of with the introduction to Winston and meeting his partner, and then he goes back to his office and there's the requisite damsel in distress with a case for him. So in that way, it feels very, very familiar. So I found it kind of enjoyable. I'm not sure if I'm going to stick for the whole series. The problem I had with it was I felt like the dialogue and the pacing were a little choppy. And I don't know if that's just trying to get my feet wet in a new series where we're kind of thrown into the middle. So maybe after another issue or two, that pacing may even out, because I'm just looking at the pacing for one issue as opposed to, you know, how it's going to play out over, you know, five or six issues or whatever it might be. So I'll probably give the second issue a read and see if it picks up for me. I will say that the style, I'm not familiar with this artist, but his style, his line work, I really like. His character design also, I really enjoy. Winston looks pretty cool. Lee Ferguson is the artist's name. And Winston, the one thing I did notice about him on the first page is, you know, those Apple commercials where, or actually they might be they're Samsung commercials that make fun of the iPhone notch, where the guy has he's standing in line. He has like the, has a notch. That's Winston has that notch. So I thought that was kind of funny. But yeah, I mean, it was a solid start. Like I said, it's interesting enough. I'm going to be back for the second issue because I trust Mike Martz. I trust those guys over Aftershock. So I have a feeling that first issue may not be the strongest issue in the series. I expect it to get better. So what do you have up next, Manny?
I have, speaking of small publishers that we like, Top Cows, Why, I don't know why this isn't coming out right.
I don't know, Mang.
A Man Among Ye.
There you go.
Number three by Stephanie Phillips, with art by Craig Sermark. I think this is, am I just wrong, or did this take like a month off?
I think they might have skipped a month.
Okay, because it feels like when it came up, I was like, oh shoot, I probably missed one. Nope, this is three.
Yeah.
So we've already, we're introduced to, you know, like Calico Jack and Bonnie, Mary Reed, And so issue three actually, more than anything, I think sets up the actual story that Phillips wants to tell. I don't really want to give away too much as far as what are those events that take place that cause this to kind of take off. But it is, I will say that it is more or less, it seems like your standard pirate story with people backstabbing each other, deals being made, and somebody's just trying to survive out on the Caribbean seas. So it'll be interesting to see if Phillips has a twist to this or and how it plays out going forward. I'm a sucker for anything pirate wise. So Pirates of the Caribbean, I love it. The only thing I will say, I did try to watch Black Sails the other day, and I could not watch it. I watched, I think, 2-3 episodes of it, and I was like, yeah, this is not for me.
And there's people that swear by that show.
I tried, man, and I love pirates, and I couldn't. It just did not work for me.
Yeah, I mean, I've never seen it. I mean, I'm a fan of Toby Stevens, but I've never seen it. But as far as A Man Among Ye, yeah, I've been enjoying it. The thing that's cool about it, you know, Anne Bonnie and Mary Read, these are real female historical characters that were really pirates. Obviously, this is greatly embellished. We don't have a lot of records about their life and events of their life and such. So, but Stephanie Phillips is a good writer, and she's a big history buff. So, you know, she's infusing a lot of realism in the story. And I hadn't been familiar with Craig Surmark's art before this, but he does a really good job of making it, you know, kind of comic booky and clean lines. It's not really murky. You know, a lot of pirate stories, they do watercolors or they go really dark to get that mood. And that's okay. Like, what was the one that came out last year? I'm drawing a blank on Joshua Hickson illustrated it. Something red or red something. Anyway, that art was really kind of murky. And while it worked, it just, you kind of get tired of that. You know, sometimes you just want some art that's, you know, nice and clean and you can kind of see what's going on. So I definitely appreciate that about A Man Among Ye. So Shanghai Red was the book I was trying to think of that.
Oh yeah. Okay.
Did with Christopher Sabella was the co-creator on that. So, all right, well, let me move on to my next book. We have so many to get through. I'm just going to mention real briefly. So Superman in Action Comics 1026, written by Brian Michael Bendis, pencils by John Romita Jr., Klaus Janson on inks, Brad Anderson on colors, and Dave Sharp on letters. This is The House of Kent, Part 5. I haven't been a big fan of Bendis's work on Superman. We all know that at this point. John Romita Jr. on pencils. We all know how I feel about that at this point. And I mean, it's just gotten to be so bad. The cover especially. I just don't understand all the, like, why are you putting in all these lines? Just like for no reason. It doesn't make any sense. Like, what's with all these lines? Like, there's just lines. There's lines on the faces. There's lines on the bodies everywhere. Like, just lines everywhere.
They don't even accent, like, they don't even do shadows or anything.
Here's Superman's chest in light lines, and then here's his arm in shadow, same lines.
And then down over here it's
just bad. It's all kinds of bad. But the reason I wanted to mention this issue is because we have finally gotten to the point, I've been reading Action Comics Bendis's run long enough now that I finally could say that I want to know what's going to happen. We're finally to the point where I'm like, okay, I've been reading this long enough. I want it to end, but I want to know how it ends. I want to know what actually happens with the, you know, the Shadow Mafia and, you know, them owning the Daily Planet and what's going to happen. And there's something happens to Lois at the end of this issue. I don't really care that much about Superman and the, you know, Supergirl and Jonathan and Connor and Brainiac 5 that are fighting against these, you know, different multiverse villains, whatever, like that part of it, the actual superhero part of it, I kind of don't care. So I guess in that way, Bendis succeeded. It felt like from the beginning of his Action Comics run, he was trying to make this a Superman crime noir book and get us interested in the Daily Planet and the machinations of the Shadow Mafia and such. So I guess in that way, he has succeeded. But my point being that, yeah, you succeeded, but at the expense of Superman. Like, you actually made me not care about the superhero aspect of it. I just want to know how the Daily Planet storyline wraps up and then, like, get Bendis off the book, which, you know, supposedly is a Superman book. So I'm fine with that. But I did want to mention that. So maybe some people have been enjoying it. I don't know. I hear very few people that enjoy Bendis's Superman work or any of his DC work, really. I think it's only Bendis fans, like hardcore Bendis fans at this point. But even some of Bendis fans, you know, they're only Marvel, so they're not going to move over to DC. So that's part of, you know, it's a whole nother, we could dedicate a whole podcast to how Bendis's move over to Marvel has been a massive failure, but, I can't wait to have him off the books, but yeah, I am curious to see what's going to happen with, the Shadow Mafia and finally wrapping up this story. And I'm also curious if we look back in 10 or 15 years, how people are going to look back with retrospect on the Bendis era of Superman. I have a feeling it's just going to be kind of forgotten and people won't even really talk about it. It's certainly not going to be remembered in the way Morrison's Batman run or Geoff Johns on Green Lantern or Mark Waid on Flash. I don't think any of that's going to happen. It's just going to be forgotten. Thankfully, you know, people just be glad it's over. All right, what do you have up next, Manny?
Next, I have DC's Batgirl Oversized issue 50. It's the final issue. So it's a giant sized issue. It is written by Cecilio Castellucci, Manuela Lupacino on pencils, Wade Von Grawbadger, Mickey Gray, Scott Hanna on inks, and Jordi Belair on colors. So I really like this issue 50, and to be honest, I hadn't been really reading any Batgirl, but the main attraction to me was the fact that this issue was going to introduce the new Batwoman, Ryan Wilder, to comic books. Now, it didn't really happen in the way where she's Batwoman or anything, but the character finally makes an appearance here, just as kind of an advocate for homelessness and just social justice. It's a direction that I think that probably Batgirl should go towards. She's dealing with all of the after effects with the Joker War, including her dad, the loss of her brother, and just trying to patch up relationships and trying to find a place in a new Gotham per se, where there is now this anti-vigilante sentiment going around. And then also you have a lot of people that are displaced and need a shelter, food, and things like that. And so she finds herself in the middle of this, and she wants to help in the best way possible, thinking that maybe Batgirl's is not going to do it. Her job, maybe not the way to do it. We see her in protest, and we see her go toe to toe with her dad, which is really interesting. But it's a part of, I think it fits her character well. And it's something that I hope that we get to see a lot more of her doing that in the future. Good issue. Good way to wrap it up, and good place for her to be right now, especially, you know, with what's really going on.
Yeah, I definitely feel like Cecil Castellucci. So there's three stories. She writes all three, and there's different artists. Obviously, the main story, like Manny mentioned, it is kind of obvious that the whole Ryan Wilder first appearance in comics is, you could take that out and the story would not be changed whatsoever. So I don't want to say it's like shoehorned in there, but it's not, she's not like pivotal to the story, but it is cool that, you know, their DC is trying to, you know, throw a bone to the TV series and vice versa by putting her in there. And it's made the issue hot already. Like if you didn't get your copy on Tuesday when the DC comic got released and you pick your books up on Wednesday, you may not even find any left on the rack. Cause I went to, I was on the other part of town where I used to live, and I went to the old shop that I used to get my books, and they had one copy of the regular cover left, and they still had several copies of the variant. So I picked up one of each just to have, because they were already selling on, even before the book went on sale, which I think it was a $6 book because it's double sized. They were selling on eBay for like 10, 12 bucks just because of speculators and Ryan Wilder. So yeah, I agree with Manny. Cecil does a great job of bringing in all the different aspects of Batgirl, wraps up the Joker War storyline really well. We know that somebody else is going to be taken over as Batgirl, probably Cassandra Cain. And for at least a little while, probably about at least a year, Barbara Gordon is going to go back to being Oracle, which makes sense with a lot of the things that she was saying here. Plus, like Manny was talking about with the anti-vigilante sentiment. And with the activism and stuff, there's mention of her as a congresswoman. And that's going way back in DC history, because Batgirl and Barbara Gordon, she was a congressman at one point. I think it was the late 70s or early 80s where that was part of Barbara Gordon's backstory, that she ran for Congress and that was how she was trying to help out. So Cecil really brought in a lot of different classic aspects of Barbara Gordon. You know, she's Batgirl, she's Oracle, she's a congresswoman, she cares about people. So yeah, I thought it was pretty well done, and it covers, you know, it's one of those issues, and Dr. Doom is like this, I'm going to be talking about a little bit. It covers a lot of material. So there's a lot of like exposition boxes as opposed to just, you know, watching some action scenes unfold. So it covers a lot. I won't say it's a dense read, but it covers a lot. There's a lot of material there to get through. And I think Cecil does a great job. And then all the art is great as in all three stories, all very different, but it's all handled really well. All right, let me go on to my next book. I'm just going to cover this one real briefly. Batman versus Superman number 13, written by Joshua Williamson. Art is by Max Rayner. Colors by Alejandro Sanchez. And letters are by John J. Hill. This is part two of the Planet Brainiac, which is a really cool concept. Brainiac basically was able to sort of hack into the... We saw this last issue, in issue 12, hack into the Bat computer and use this program that Batman had written that was supposed to try to help the Justice League be more proactive rather than reactive. You know, it was supposed to predict when a villain might do something or predict when an event might go wrong, and they could be there before things went bad as opposed to waiting till the bank is robbed and then trying to catch the robbers, or waiting till, you know, whoever it is, Ultra Humanite, has bombs planted all over Metropolis and then trying to stop them. You know, this program he was writing was supposed to predict these sort of events so they could be in front of it. And Brainiac hacks into that back computer. He gains that program as well as all the knowledge for all the villains and heroes that Batman has ever had. So you can imagine, you know, Batman does his homework on these people. So Brainiac's got this huge treasure trove of data, and what he decides to do with it is spoilery, so I'm not going to talk about that. But Batman and Superman are definitely up for a big, big challenge. So it's been a really fun story so far. And I think overall, the whole Batman-Superman title has been really fun. It feels classic DC superhero-ish, and I don't hear a lot of people talking about it. And so I wanted to give it a shout-out. I think Joshua Williamson is doing a great job. And the art by Max Rayner, the colors by Alejandro Sanchez, they're all just pitch perfect. You know, colors are really bright and vibrant. The line work is done really well. There's some great scenes, both action scenes and character interactions. So I definitely wanted to give it a shout out. If you're looking for something in the DC universe that's standalone, that's not tying in with all the death metal stuff or the Joker War stuff or what have you, just pick up Batman versus Superman because it stands alone. You don't have to worry about any other continuity. What do you have up next, Manny?
Up next, I have Detective 1029, however you want to call it. So this is the start of a new arc. Who are you? stories by Peter Tomasi, with artwork and the cover by Kenneth Rockefort, and the colors I cannot see down here. Can't see who that says. It's blurry. I'm not sure why. just like some, most of the other books, these are things that are spinning out of Joker War, and obviously we saw the last issue where there's going to be somebody running for mayor that's going to be anti-vigilante, anti-Bat family, and so part of the book is really dealing with the idea of a Gotham without vigilantes, or a Gotham that is no longer in support of vigilantes, and we are introduced to this new character that is called the Mirror, which I wanted to get your opinion on it because I kind of rolled my eyes at it because he's up there talking with, this is in the beginning of the book, so it's probably even in the preview pages, so whatever, I can talk about it. He's talking about how bad Batman and the rest of the Bat family are for Gotham, yet he himself is wearing a mask. And his explanation, I find to be complete BS. And I rolled my eyes so hard back, I felt like the Undertaker. He says, "I wear this mask because that was the reflection, because I am all of you. And so when you look into me, you should see yourself and every one of you, because we're in this together." And I was like, you know, we go, man, you take your stupid self-righteous, like, no, you have devious plans, and that's why you're wearing a damn mask. I understand this is a comic book, and I'm probably taking this too far. But it's fine within the book, but I'm just saying that as far as his character motivations, I've already found him to be not. There's that he has something else going on. With that said, I do hope that what is kind of teased in this detective book is that we're going to see a lot more Bruce Wayne, because of the fact that there's this feeling of anti-vigilante, and we see that in this issue. I kind of hope that we get to see that alter ego that he uses sometimes. What is his name? Malone?
Matches Malone.
I hope that he makes a comeback for a couple of issues, maybe for Detective. I'm very interested to see where Detective is going because of that. It just seems like it's going to be different than whatever the Batman book is going to be, and that's where I want my Detective Comics. Overall, I think it's really good, and I hope it still steers it this same way.
Yeah, I mean, I see where you're coming from, and I agree. I thought that too. Here's this guy complaining about masks, and he's covered up. And then his explanation, well, I know I'm wearing a mask, but when you look at me, you see yourself. So I'm all of you, you know, because it's a reflection. It's a cop-out. You're still hiding your identity. But it's a comic book explanation. It's not, you know. But yeah, I get it. But he does look cool, even though you think, okay, I mean, the way Rockefort draws his clothes, it looks like it's cloth, but yet it's reflective. Like,
it looks a lot like that character from Watchmen, one of the new characters. I forget his name.
I didn't watch it, but
yeah, he has a fully reflective mask just like that.
I mean, that's cool on the mask.
But
how are you wearing he's wearing like a button down shirt, and yet somehow it's reflect. I want material like that, where it looks like my shirt is dipped in chrome. It still moves like cloth, but it's reflective. That would be cool. The way it plays out in the first issue, it seems like the guy that we saw first in Detective 1027, then and again in 1028, who's now running for mayor, and I can't remember his name.
His name is, I just had it right here.
He used to be a police officer.
Nakano.
Yeah, Nakano, that's right. And, you know, his partner got killed in the Joker Wars. He was a police officer and he lost his eye. And now he's running for mayor and he's running on the whole anti-vigilante thing. It seems like they're trying to hint that, hey, this is who the mirror is. It's this guy. But I mean, that might be too obvious and it might turn out to be somebody else. Maybe it's his wife. Maybe it's his partner. Maybe his partner's not really dead. But I am curious to see who the mirror turns out to be. I hope it turns out to be somebody cool and doesn't end up feeling cheesy. Lately, I feel like when they've introduced people and then you find out who they are, you're like, that's kind of a disappointment or a letdown. So hopefully we don't fall into that trap. All right. Up next, I'm going to talk about The Flash, number 764, written by Kevin Shinnick. Art is by Will Conrad. Letters are by Hi-Fi. Colors are by Hi-Fi. Letters are by Steve Wands. So I talked about 763, Kevin Shinnick's first work on The Flash. He'd done some comic work before. Most of his professional work has been done in television, especially on Robot Chicken. And so he is a writer. He is creative. But the first issue wasn't a disappointment, but it didn't wow me. I wasn't like, really excited about it. I just thought it was okay. It was a cool sort of one and done Flash story. I guess you could say it sort of gave us Kevin Shinnick's outlook on who Barry Allen is as a character, his optimism and what makes him tick. And there were little hints and seeds planted in the story that you could build on. And so even though it felt like a one and done, Shinnick has given us another issue, and I think he gets to write one more before Flash then goes on, or maybe even two more, because if we get two issues in November, and then in December it goes on hiatus for the Eternal Winter storyline, and then obviously January, February, we have the future state, and then who knows if Shinnick comes back in March or not. But that excitement that I felt was missing in his first story, and granted, this, even though the first one felt like a one and done, this one is with this ring part two. So it is part two of the story, and it is building off the events that happened in the last couple pages of the last issue. But what I love about this and why I am excited about seeing what Kevin Shinnick can do on Flash now is because it's classic DC, it's classic Flash, in that what Shinnick is doing is he's taking a member of the Flash Rogues Gallery, which, after Batman and after Spider-Man, Flash probably has the best Rogues Gallery. I mean, they even call themselves the Rogues, short for Rogues Gallery. So he's taking one of them, Dr. Alchemy in this case, and he's leveling him up. And he's not just arbitrarily doing it where he's just like, oh, he's magically more powerful. Like, he's explaining to us how Dr. Alchemy is trying to get better and raise his game and be more dangerous and be more of a threat to the Flash. And it ends up, he is a threat to the Flash. Like, he's, I won't go so far as to say Barry Allen underestimates him in the issue, but you see Dr. Alchemy as a real threat. And so it feels like there's consequences and it feels like there's stakes. And I really enjoyed this issue. I was really impressed. Like I said, and it wasn't that Kevin Shinnick's first issue was terrible. I just was kind of like, okay, it was a comic, it was a story. But this one, I am impressed. He does a really great job of ratcheting up the action, ratcheting up the stakes. And Will Conrad, he's a really good artist when it comes to giving us classic superhero action. There's a big fight scene in this issue with a lot of action. And he gives us some interesting page layouts and panel layouts. And I feel like Shinnick is mining some older stuff from the history of the DC universe, as well as kind of real world history. And so that plays in really well, and it's illustrated well by Conrad also. So yeah, all in all, a really solid issue. If you're a Flash fan and you got turned off by kind of the drawn out story that Joshua Williamson was telling over a long period of time, I have a feeling you might want to jump back on. I'm sure you can find issue 763, part one of With This Ring pretty easily. And then you're going to pick up part two and be like, oh yeah, now I remember why I love The Flash. It's like classic superhero stories with him running around, using his powers in interesting ways and being challenged by the villains. So props to Kevin Shinnick for a great second issue of his Flash run. All right. What do you have next, Manny?
I have Red Hood Outlaw 50. And that is written by Scholar down. And I love saying that because he has been the only one writing Red Hood Outlaw, and I will continue to say that until he's done. And he just might be done.
Yeah, this should be the final issue.
Yeah. No, it is, and I'm being kind of the butt about it. So with artwork by Paolo Pantalena and colors by Arif Priato. So yeah, like we talked about, this is an extra size anniversary issue because it's issue 50, and it is literally what the cover says, the Outlaws era end. Kind of like that one moment in or that Fast and the Furious movie where Brian and Toretto kind of go their own different ways, and then Sean Smith's song hits. That's kind of what this is. It kind of recaps a little bit of the journey that they've been through, and more than anything, actually, it takes a look at Dwella Dent and what Jason's able to do for her as far as putting her on the right path, despite of the fact that she's been poisoned by that whole Joker persona as the Joker's daughter. And I thought that was a very good moment for him, and a little bit of a redemption on his end for what's going on. And then also it kind of see what everybody else is up to, except for Bizarro, who we all know he stayed in hell last issue. So I found it to be very satisfying. If you enjoyed, nothing really big happens here. Nothing that's going to be kind of newsworthy, but I think that the way he wraps it up with a bow overall, I found it very satisfying. And I kind of thank Glabdell for a really, really good, solid Red Hood Outlaw run, because I never really felt like dropping the book, not once throughout this whole thing. And we've seen how many of these books have gone through different creators, which isn't always a bad thing. But in this case for Red Hood Outlaw, I think that it progressed well. We saw the growth from Bizarro. That was fantastic. Artemis and so solid run overall. Very happy, and I hope that hopefully people pick it up in trades and give it a shot if they haven't, just because the consistency is there because of the creative team. That's all I can really say about that.
Yeah, I haven't read Red Hood and the Outlaw since like the first five issues, so I can't really add anything. All right, next book I'm going to talk about from IDW, it's Canto 2, The Hollow Men, number 3, from David M. Buher, and art by Drew Zucker, inks by Philip Seve, and colors by Vittorio Astoni. So if you're not familiar with Canto, it's basically an all-ages story about these clockwork beings, these clockwork knights that had been enslaved by this sort of evil wizard called the Shrouded Man. And in Canto 1, the first miniseries, Canto goes on a quest and he manages to free his people. And then in Canto 2, we find out that even though he thought he freed his people, turns out he didn't, because the wizard has put a curse on them that their clockwork hearts are going to run down and they're not going to be able to be wound. And basically it means that unless Canto and his people return to Shrouded Man, they're all going to die. So Canto's on a quest to defeat the Shrouded Man once and for all, and this time he's taken along some other clockwork knights as well to help him. So it's a really fun all ages book. You can read it with your kids, great as a bedtime story. And I can't really say too much about anything that happens in the issue without spoiling, other than to say, just overall, when you talk about this being a great all-ages book, it has some very central, high-minded themes that can easily be understood even by younger readers. You know, ideas like friendship and loyalty and sacrifice and heroism and what it means to be a friend and to give yourself to something bigger than yourself and to put others before you. And so for that reason, I think it's perfect as a book for younger readers. I'll mention it every time a new issue hits stands because it's that good. And the art is really fun. Drew Zucker's line work is great. You know, these Clockwork Knights don't have what you would consider normal facial expressions or facial features, I should say. So a lot of the expressiveness is in the eyes or kind of the body language. The colors are very primary, which, you know, kind of suits a book that is kind of aimed at younger readers. And it's just a really fun story. And even though I'm talking about how great it is for kids, I enjoy reading it because it's just, it's fun. It's not, you know, dark and gloomy in the way so many, you know, of these books are these days. Are supposed to be, you know, avant-garde and cutting edge and whatever, gritty and grim. This is just, you know, fun fantasy adventure with, you know, likable characters who you can relate to. And, you know, it's much more of the good versus evil or black versus white. There's not a lot of, you know, gray areas or moral ambiguity or questions like that, that you've got to, you know, spend a lot of time thinking about. It's really straightforward and it's a good, fun read. So always recommend Canto when it's on the stands. What do you have up next, Manny?
Up next, we're going to go over to, I'm kind of laughing because I'm looking at how many books I still have left. I was like, oh my God, we still have a long way to go. My next book is DC's Wonder Woman 765. This is written by, we're keeping the same creative team, Mariko Tamaki, with Steve Puh as the artist, and colorist is Romulo Fajardo Jr. Thank you. And then some cool covers by David Marquez and Alejandro Sanchez. So this issue, we see Maxwell Lord and Diana Wonder Woman in the fictional Zandia, which is a super villain or just villain country, I guess, and it's where they need to go because it's where the black market deal is going to go down, supposedly, for his technology, because of his technology, Maxwell Lord's technology, which had been released by Liar a couple of issues ago. It's a pretty cookie cutter issue as it introduces kind of who is going to be an antagonist for maybe a couple of issues. And then I hope that on the screen, they kind of tease some villains. I see that they have the suit gang, with the king and the queen, the jack, 10 and the ace. Hopefully we get to see them sometime in the near future, but I'm not going to hold my breath. I don't want to reveal who's got a hold or who they suspect to have a hold of his technology, because mixed with his powers, I think it does make for a very interesting story. I hate the dynamic between Maxwell Lord and Wonder Woman, because I just don't buy it. We kind of saw in the last issue where it was teased a little bit that Maxwell was up to his little shenanigans, but in this issue, it's still coming up as a buddy cop type of series or storyline, and I don't like it. I think right now, Wonder Woman needs to be more than somebody's partner, especially with Maxwell Lord. I feel like she needs to be represented more, kind of like Batman and Superman, or just very heroic and kind of that. I just don't. There's other characters you can put in a story like this that'll work the same way. I just think she deserves bigger stage, and nothing against Tamaki. It's just kind of bland, and it almost seems like they're side missions that she honestly wouldn't really worry about. I don't know how you see it.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of agree with you. I hate to, you know, keep beating this dead horse, but I just feel like the book would feel more consequential with a big artist on there like Mikkel Janin, who left the book. It's not that Pugh's art is bad. I mean, I totally get what you're saying. The whole Maxwell Lord thing, it kind of, it sounded interesting to me in the beginning to put that dynamic of Diana and Max together, because, you know, she snapped his neck at one point when he was dead. Or killed him, and then, you know, they got brought back through various, you know, revisions and what have you. But yeah, it's not really working that great. Something's just not clicking. And I think with Janine there on art, it would raise it up a notch, but I still don't know if it would be delivering on the promise that we got. I kind of doubt it, that it would be delivering on the promise we got of their first issue, which I thought was so good. The best thing I can say about this issue is it was better than the previous issue, which
was
on the beach and it was like super corny. At least this one felt like the story was moving forward and we're getting to see, you know, bring in another supervillain who's an interesting choice for a super or for a Wonder Woman villain, because as far as I know, this villain's never fought Wonder Woman before. So maybe, like I was saying, at the beginning of the first issue, you know, trying to establish more of a rogues gallery for Wonder Woman. So, but yeah, I totally agree with what you're saying. She should be able to stand on her own and the book should feel more consequential and just bigger, and it doesn't. So it's kind of disappointing. All right. Well, let me move on to my next title. So this is the first Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle comic I've read since I can remember. I was never that big into the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. Obviously I was around and collecting comics when the first issue came out, but I was buying them off the rack at my local store. So it was newsstand. I wasn't, you know, going to a comic book shop. I wasn't old enough to drive or anything like that. So I didn't get a chance to pick it up, but obviously I heard about it. Everybody did back then, you know, in the early 80s, and then eventually the cartoons and the movies. I never watched the cartoon. I never saw any of the movies. It just wasn't my thing. I probably played the video game, you know, once in a while or whatever. But when I heard about this story, I was like, well, you know, I've never really read or gotten into Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, even though they've been popular in recent years with them coming up with a female turtle and that issue sells for like hundreds of dollars now, what have you. But when I heard that Peter Laird had kind of buried the hatchet with Kevin Eastman, which I think there's an episode of How It's Made it's called on Netflix, and they're talking about turtles, and that does a great job of going over how they had a falling out over some creative differences and the control of the turtles and that kind of thing.
The toys that made us.
Yeah, the toys that made us. That's what it was. Yeah, thanks. So anyway, they just recently patched things up, and this last Ronin story is basically the fruits of that mending of that relationship, to where they're telling the story, a story decades and decades in the future of the last Ronin, when there's only one turtle left, and what his mission is and how he wants to kind of accomplish things. So you might think if this is the last story, whatever, you need to, you know all about the turtles and what, man, I'm telling you, as somebody who doesn't have that much turtle knowledge at all, like I know the names of the four turtles, but I couldn't sit here and tell you, okay, Michelangelo uses the bow and Donatello uses the staff and Leonardo uses the katana and who's the last one?
A bow? What?
Yeah, a staff. That's what I meant, a staff.
Oh, okay.
Staff or a bow. I guess that staff and bow is the same thing. So you have one guy uses the sai, one guy uses the staff, one guy uses the nunchucks, and one guy uses the katana, right? And who am I forgetting? There's Leonardo, Michelangelo, Donatello, Raphael. Is the last one. I couldn't tell you who's what color. Like in the original comics, it was black and white, and then in the cartoon,
Super Nintendo game.
I didn't play it, but I know that's how they, when they came out with the cartoon, that's how they identified who was who, right? Like one guy had blue, one guy had purple, one guy had orange. I think one guy had red or green.
Yeah, Raphael.
Yeah. So anyway, in the black and white comic, the only way you could tell the turtles apart was by what weapon they were using.
It wasn't until they put them into cartoons that they actually give them colors.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, then eventually they had color. And I don't even know if when they had color comics, because they moved over from their own independent, I think it was, I want to say Mirage Studios. Anyway, then it moved over to, it was Archie published them for a while and they were in color, but I don't know if they used the color-coded masks or whatever. But it, like classic Turtle fans will tell you, it was always about the weapons. That's how you could tell them apart. So when this got announced and you saw the cover for Last Ronin, people were wondering, well, which turtle is the Last Ronin? Because when you look on the covers, and there's about, I don't know, 100 covers for this, because there's like cover A, cover B, and then there's some convention exclusives, and then there's like a ton of retailer exclusives. Like there are so many variants. I literally think there might be like almost 100 different variants, because you get the retailer exclusive, you get like the regular retailer exclusive, and then you get a version or a virgin version where there's no, you know, trade dress on it. So there's so many covers. But anytime you look at the covers, the last turtle, he's got all four of the weapons. So there's no way to really know which turtle it is, which you find out in this first issue, at the end of the first issue. And you also see a character show up that you don't necessarily expect to show up, kind of a classic turtle character, just because it's so far in the future. And anyway, it's a really great read. And even if you're like me and you're turtle knowledge is severely limited, that's okay. This is a great jumping on point. Just the way that Laird and Eastman lay the story out, they give you all the information you need to know, just through exposition and the events of the story. Plus, you know, so much time has gone by, it's not tied into any like current continuity for the IDW current turtle book that's coming out now, so you don't need anything to know anything that's going on there. So it's just a really fun comic that feels, you know, very, very turtle-ish, I guess you would say, in terms of from what I've read of the classic Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. And the fact that that it's Eastman and Laird, you know, the original co-creators of the Turtles, that are working together on a story along with Tom Waltz, I just think that really lends some credibility to it and probably helps it feel like those classic turtle stories that, you know, people loved back in the day when it first came out. So hey, you've got Eastman, Laird, and Tom Waltz on story. You've got Tom Waltz and Kevin Eastman handling the script. Layouts are by Kevin Eastman. Pencils/inks by Esau and Isaac Escorza, Escorza. Page 39 art by Ben Bishop. Color assist by Samuel Plata. Colors by Luis Antonio Delgado. Letters are by Sean Lee. And I couldn't even begin to start telling you who does what covers, because like I said, there's about 100 of them. So this was one of those that it kind of snuck up on people. A lot of people who don't normally read Turtles like myself are picking this thing up. And what happened was the reorders, like after the book had already been sent to the printer with its initial number of orders and initial print run, so many reorders came in, so many, you know, final order cutoff orders came in for the book, that there were more requests for the book from retailers than they actually printed. So they knew even before, I mean, they knew like 3 or 4 weeks ago that it was going to be allocated, because they only printed 130,000 copies. And I don't know if that gets into all the retail covers or not. So if you want a first print, there's, like I said, plenty of retailers out there that are doing exclusive, where you can probably go, but you're going to have to pay like $20 to get their retailer exclusive, as opposed to if you pick up the regular first print, if you're able to find one, it's $8.99. But there already is going to be a second print. They've already announced a big second printing, probably a second printing, maybe even bigger than the first one. I don't know. And I think that's coming out the first week of December. So if you're a Turtle fan, it's a must read. If you're curious about the Turtles and you can find a copy, I would pick it up. And if you're just a casual Turtle fan, you know, and you can get your hands on a copy and flip through it, you may just want to pick it up, even though it's that $8.99 cover price, because I really enjoyed it. And I'm definitely going to read this whole story. I mean, I think it's really, really good. you're a Turtle fan, man. I know you've read Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles from IDW, the regular series, at times. Are you off it now? You haven't been keeping up on it?
I just haven't been keeping up with it. Turtles are great. They're just not on my top list of priorities right now.
All right. Well, I mean, I didn't even send you the preview copy. You didn't mention anything. You probably didn't even realize it was out, but
you want to send it to me? I definitely.
Yeah, it's good. It's good. I really enjoyed it. So you probably get, I mean, if you're a big Turtle fan, I'm sure you get much more out of it than me, because there's probably some in jokes there, because there was a few things where I was like, they're referring to something, but I have no idea. So anyway, what do you have up next?
It's another book that actually flew under my radar that you graciously sent to me despite not asking for it. Dark Knight's Death Metal, Rise of the New God, written by James Tynion IV, with pencils by Jesus Marino, ink by Vicente Cifuentes, colors by Ulises Arreola. If you've been keeping up with the podcast, Dark Knight's Death Metal, not really my thing. It's kind of bland. It's kind of too over the top for the story that I feel like it's trying to tell. And here we are with Rise of the New God, which I find interesting that it's titled that, because I don't really think it has much to do with him. we see him in the background throughout the issue fighting Perpetua, but that's really it. This story actually really focuses on a character called, how do you pronounce that, Chronicler?
Yeah, I think the Chronicler, who's, as far as I know, this is his first appearance.
The Chronicler. He's like the Riddler, but he just writes stuff down.
Basically, that's what he does. So if he doesn't even write it, he just has a magic book that writes stuff
in it. Yeah, so he's like Metron, but...
but for the whole Omniverse.
Yeah, but for like... Omniverse. So yeah, I didn't even think that there was more to it, but he shows up. His whole thing is that he shows up when something's about to end, and he chronicles it. He writes it down to make sure that it stays in history. And as he's going through to different characters, he's finding out really the value of this multiverse, which all it really does is it really gives the reader hope that this Dark Knight's Death Metal, that there is hope for it, because this guy all of a sudden feels sorry for this multiverse. Which at the same time, though, he keeps mentioning, no, I'm doing this because you guys are screwed.
Yeah, well, the other thing that he mentions throughout, and again, we don't want to get too spoilery, but he's right. Kind of like the Watcher in the Marvel Universe. He chronicles things, and as much as he's kind of inspired by the hope that the heroes of the DC universe have and how they've turned back Annihilation so many times, he's not supposed to, just like the Watcher. He's just supposed to be writing things down. He's not supposed to directly interfere with anything.
Yeah, he keeps saying that, so which gives me the idea that he's going to interfere.
Yeah, exactly.
anywho, it was cool. Out of everything, I think that they've thrown at us, it makes probably the most sense and the most DC multiverse thing that I've seen in a while. I'm glad that I didn't have to see a billion Batmans, and I find it really funny. It's in the first pages, so I'll mention it, how he just kind of mentions how insignificant the Joker is. And I was like, oh yeah, stick to the Joker. Because right now I think we've had too much Joker. And we'll get to that in a minute. Also in this book is The Weight of Leadership, written by Brian Hill, who we talked about a little bit earlier, with art by Nick Viriella and colors by Hi-Fi. So this really just a short story on how the Green Lanterns and the people they rescued during multiverses and get to Earth Zero. Again, a little bit of hope, a little bit of conversation between John Stewart and Jessica, and just a good little story. Nothing too extra with it. But yeah, overall, one of the more enjoyable issues I think I've had from the Darth Knight Metal series. And so I'm just so ready to wrap this up.
Yeah, so there was a reason that I heard some people talking, and this is pure speculation, pure rumor, that something about this Rise of the New God issue is tying in with the Marvel DC crossover that so many creators have been kind of clamoring for. You know, Donny Cates and Tom King and a bunch of other people, they're saying somehow this ties in. I don't see it. I didn't pick up on that at all when I read it, and then I heard somebody talking about it today, and they were saying how, if you look at it, that Chronicler guy, he looks like Cosmic Ghost Rider. But he certainly doesn't act like Cosmic Ghost Rider. I don't think there's any, I don't think there's any truth to that. But if the Chronicler is, you know, somebody who is higher than the multiverse, he's, you know, checks out the Omniverse, there's no reason the Marvel universe, the Marvel multiverse, couldn't be part of the Omniverse. So maybe the Chronicle, if they ever do another Marvel DC crossover, and who knows, that this could be the guy that instigates it. So it could down the road have some significance like that. I mean, even if they do another crossover, it's not like, I can't even remember the guy's name, the Amalgam guy. It's not like his first appearance sells for any money. You can get it for a dollar. So even if that does happen, I don't necessarily see this as being, you know, a highly sought after issue just because it has this Chronicler guy in it. I will say that one of the things I enjoyed was the art by Jesus Moreno is awesome. And like the first thing I thought when I was reading this, I was like, man, this guy needs to do more stuff. Like, what has he been doing? I can't remember him doing anything in a while. His art is so good. And then the other thing was that there's a moment that happens in this issue. And this moment is the reason I wanted you to read it, Manny, is because this doesn't happen very often where I'm surprised in a comic. And there is a point where the Chronicler picks up somebody's skull. And then when we turn the page and find out who it is that he's resurrecting, out loud, I was like, whoa, I just didn't see that coming. And I thought that was really cool and a really great way to bring back that character, who is a character I think is interesting, and it's great to see him back on the stage. So yeah, I think as far as death metal issues go, crossovers are the one shots and the single issues so far, I think this might be my favorite one. Like, it was really, really good, to the point where after I read it, I'd already ordered the regular cover, but I was like, man, this is so good, I think maybe I want the variant cover. So I went to look to see what variant covers there are. The only variant cover there is by Boss Logic, and it's one of 250, I think. A one of 250 variants. So it was going for like $100. And I didn't even like the cover. I didn't like it at all. It was just red background with the Darkest Knight or the Batman Who Laughs Last, whatever he's called now, the new iteration of him. It's just red with a side view of him, but he's like made out of smoke. Like his outline is not defined, and that's it. That's the whole cover. And I was like, $100 for that? Nope, not even. I mean, it would have had to be it would have had to be like the best cover I'd ever seen in my life for me to pay $100 for a new book. You got it. So anyway, I thought it was really good. I really enjoyed it. So I wanted to be sure Manny saw it. All right. Next up, I have Department of Truth number 2 from writer James Tynan. Art is by Martin Simmons. Letters are by Adita Bidikar. Designed by Dylan Todd. Not as impactful as the first issue, especially what we find out on the last page of the first issue. Even though it's the last issue, I'm still not going to spoil it. I will spoil a little bit of what the Department of Truth is. So basically the premise of this is that, you know, all those crazy conspiracy theories that you hear or you have heard or have existed throughout time, sometimes they're true and sometimes they're not. And the Department of Truth, what they do is they're trying to constantly squash the conspiracies that are out there in the world. And so basically what the the story postulates is that when enough people are buying into or believing a conspiracy theory, then it manifests itself as reality. So basically, like right now in our world, to put it in realistic terms or real world terms, if enough of us believed that the world was flat, the world would become flat. If enough of us believed that there were lizard people, you know, running the governments of the world, then there really would be lizard people running the governments of the world. So what the Department of Truth tries to do is it tries to quash these rumors. And nowadays, you know, on the internet and through all kinds of other things, they try to manipulate information and manipulate what people believe and are exposed to so they can keep the world spinning and keep these crazy conspiracy theories from overtaking us. So this was a solid issue. It's still a very interesting series with some very interesting ideas. It is not at all my style of art. It's painted, it's watercolor. It's not the style of art that I normally go for. It certainly does work for the mood and the tone of the story, where nothing is quite what it seems, and even reality itself can warp. So in that way, it suits the story very well. Again, it's purely an aesthetic thing on my part that it's just not the style of art that I like. It would feel completely different if it was traditional comic book art, and I don't know if it would work as well. So I'm not saying that it should be a different style of art. I just, for me, it's a little impressionist, and it's just not the style of art that I prefer. But it is really good. James Tynan continues to show why he's one of the best writers in comics, and it's a really interesting idea, really interesting concept, especially in recent years with what's happened in the political landscape of this country, where not even the truth isn't even the truth anymore. The truth is all of a sudden subjective, and so this is kind of taking that idea to the extreme, and it's really interesting. So what do you have up next, Manny?
All right, I've been putting this one off.
Must be three Jokers.
It is Batman, Three Jokers, issue 3 of 3. And like we've been speculating, how much could actually take place in one more issue based on what we had seen in the first two issues? The answer is exactly what we thought, and I don't know how much of this you agree with me. By the end of it, I felt like nothing happened. Here's what we got. We got the retelling of Batgirl's trauma when she got shot. We got the retelling of Jason Todd's trauma when he died or got killed by the Joker. And we had the retelling of Batman's childhood trauma with Joe Chill. And that's really it. I mean, we don't necessarily find out who the Joker is. And their kind of scheme of how the Joker has had different personas, while interesting, is also kind of dumb, because the Joker really kind of loses, I think, a lot of credibility if he can be multiple people, or his personality can be injected into different personalities to make him a certain way, which is why you had the comedian, which is why you had what were the other ones?
Clown and criminal.
Clown and criminal, thank you. Because, I waited years for this to supposedly give me some sort of closure as to the Joker's identity. And then he had three identities. And then in the beginning of this issue, he had a huge number of identities that didn't work. Nothing happened. As a matter of fact, he ended up getting kicked again by Batman, and it's a little spoilery, I know, but whatever. It's the same story that we've seen, and to be honest, we pretty much saw this exact same setup in a Joker War, over on Batman. We saw the theater and dealing with his trauma, except that they focus a little bit more on Alfred rather than his parents. And then Batgirl had to deal with him again, and so did Jason Todd. I guess it's bad timing because you're pretty much doing the same thing. But I mean, with how much we're paying for these books specifically and how long we waited for them, it needed to be more, because it's not like it really left a lot to be desired or a lot to be to say that, oh, then there's going to be this big event later in 2021, 2022, where this is going to cause an impact. It's none of that. It's just another Joker story. And I wouldn't be surprised if these books go down in value. It's just disappointing. I mean, besides the artwork, which is amazing, because Jason Fabok obviously is my favorite artist. I'm a little biased, but you can look at it and see I'm right. There's not much to say about it. It's just Jason Todd shot somebody. That's really the main plot of the last of the three books. Jason Todd shot one of the Jokers, and that's what we talk about the most.
Yeah, we saw that in issue one. So I agree with you. Ultimately, it's disappointing, and there's a lot of reasons for it, and we could speculate or whatever, and I don't want to get, you know, any more spoilery than Manny already has. And it's tough to critique this book without getting spoilery, but you could look at a lot of different reasons for it. Okay, first of all, I brought expectations to it, and that's on me. But based on Batman's reaction when he sat in the Mobius chair in Justice League 50, and that's who the Joker is, there's three Joker, whatever, that those are big things. And then we didn't get answers to that here. And I'm not even, in reading it, I'm not even clear that we got answers to how there was three Jokers. It's not like they say, okay, this is why there were three Jokers. It's kind of hinted at, but you're not really sure. You could take it. Have there been multiple Jokers? Have there not been multiple? And like Geoff Johns doesn't want to answer that question. That's fine. Do they want to leave it ambiguous? They don't want to actually give us the name or tell us who the Joker is, his identity revealed. That's fine. That a lot of that might go into when Geoff Johns was writing Justice League, and when Geoff Johns gave us gave us the promise of the three Jokers, he had a lot of clout at DC. Diane Nelson was still the president, you know, his good friend, and editorially, and you know, he was the chief creative officer. And now when this finally finishes, he doesn't have much clout at all. And so that may have had a lot to do with why things changed. Plus the DC universe, this took so long to come out. The DC universe itself has moved on. You know, if this comes out the first year and a half of Rebirth, you know, maybe it ties in much better. But things have changed so much that now it's like, who knows how much the story changed based on the overall continuity and where the DC universe is now, how much that changed. So you can look at some of the failures, you know, or I look at some of the disappointment of the series as saying, well, you know, it might not necessarily be John's fault because things changed out from under him because this took so long to come out. Did it take so long to come out because Fabok was taking his time on the art? Well, that very well may be. And I think that time was worth it because the art is probably the best of Fabok's career and it's spectacular. But then you run the risk of these kind of editorial, you know, having the editorial rug pulled out from under you. So that, you know, and who knows how much DC got involved and meddled with the story. We just don't know. We never will. So you can kind of, I don't know if you can put blame on anybody for that. The blame of thinking it's going to be a big story, well, that's how it was marketed. I think that's how DC intimated, they sold it as that. And then it wasn't that, at least that's how I took it. So, you know, you can maybe blame some of the failure on my expectations. And, you know, go into something with expectations, you go in inherently with the possibility of being let down. That's just the way things are. So that makes it tough. It didn't end up feeling like a big story. If you look at this in a vacuum, though, if you look at it just, okay, let me look at this as a standalone story that doesn't have anything to do with Justice League 50 from John's run and nothing to do with, you know, Rebirth or anything going on in the DC Universe now. Let me just look at it as these three books as a standalone story. I think it's way above average, but you could say that about all John's work. And certainly we've talked about how great Fabuck's art is, but it's still a small story. And it doesn't necessarily feel impactful, but it's still a quality story. And I think the biggest reason, because like Manny said, it does deal a lot with the trauma of these three characters, which is worth exploring. But the way, and again, I don't want to get too spoilery, but the way what the Joker had planned kind of backfired in the end. And that's the only thing that I think really is a saving grace for the story and does make it above average. Because Batman, Bruce Wayne, he does something to the Joker's plan. He flips it on his head by doing something that we've never seen Batman do. I don't know if you know what I'm talking about, Manny. We may have to talk about it after. But it's just something we haven't seen the Batman do before in terms of, you know, his trauma and such. And so that's maybe if there's a lasting legacy, it could be that. But who knows? Ultimately, I feel like it's a disappointment. Is it above average? Yes. Do I recommend picking it up? I would not recommend paying $7 an issue for it, but if you pick up the collected and it's less, or if you're a big fan of Jason Fabok's art, or you're a big Geoff Johns fan, but I wouldn't expect people to pay $7. This is just a regular Batman story, you know? It really feels like this could have been, earlier today I was talking to somebody about it. I was like, it really feels like those issues from about 405 to 450-ish, where you would get these little 4 or 5, 6 issue arcs that were kind of standalone. And at that time, the Batman title was very insulated. It didn't have much to do with the rest of the DC universe. And you just get these great quality stories that just felt very focused on Batman and Bruce Wayne and who he was. And they were great. It's one of my favorite eras of Batman. But they're not $7 an issue, you know, they're just classic Batman stories. So yeah, ultimately it was better than average, but I wouldn't go out of my way to, I wouldn't even spend $7 on it. And I think the first issue, I think I even bought 2 covers. I spent even more. So, all right, well, let me move on to my next book. It's Undiscovered Country, number 9. This is from writer Scott Snyder and Charles Soule, with art by Giuseppe Comancola and Leonardo Marcello Grossi, with colors by Matt Wilson and letters by Crank. If you're not familiar, basically the United States 30 years ago put up these walls and said, we're isolating ourselves from the rest of the world, cut off all communications, cut off travel, all that. Anybody that was in the United States was there, and anybody who was outside of the United States, too bad. Abandoned Hawaii and Puerto Rico and Guam and all that kind of thing. And instead of 50 states, they transformed the interior of the United States into 13 territories. And each territory was responsible for providing certain goods and services to the other 12. So some were, you know, more technological, some were more agricultural, things like that. And time has moved at a different pace, at a much faster pace inside the walls of this walled off country. And now some people are finally going and they're exploring because there's a plague that's threatening to wipe out all of civilization outside the United States. So they're hoping the U.S. has a cure. So, so far we've seen 2 of the territories. The first one was kind of Mad Maxi, and the second one is very technologically advanced. And we're learning more about what happened in the immediate aftermath of the sealing, they call it. Sealing as in seal something off. And so it's what's really interesting is Snyder and Charles Soule came up with this idea long before the pandemic. They were working on it for years. And now with this pandemic and how it's raging out of control here in the U.S., we are sealed off. Like, we're not allowed to travel to other countries and people aren't coming here, and things are kind of falling apart to some extent. And so it's interesting how prescient this book has become all of a sudden. And so I'm very curious to see where it goes. And the other thing that I want to mention is that right around San Diego Comic-Con time, Charles and Scott did a bunch of like live video streams where they were taking questions, and I had asked a question, and I thought it was a really good question, and they never addressed it in the live chat. And then I see in the back of this issue, they have a Q&A, and I'm right there, the first question. And it basically is asking about the relationship between a couple of the explorers, Daniel and Charlotte, who are brother and sister, and if we're going to see more of that dynamic between them. And they said, yeah, they're definitely going to be exploring that. And Charles goes on to say that really that's what's at the core of the story. As crazy and wild as things get, the characters are the most important, and they're the ones we relate to. And the different dynamics and interactions between this group that's gone into the sealed off United States are kind of our point of view and kind of our sounding board. And they're really at the heart of the story. The way they react would be the way we react. And it gives us kind of a window into, you know, the emotional aspect of the story. So thanks to Scott and Charles for answering my question and throwing it in the back of the issue. That was really cool. And I had no idea that it was in there. So that was really great. And then the artwork by Giuseppe Camuncola and Leonardo Marcello Grassi, it's been spectacular the whole time. It's very detailed. It's very weird because, again, this is a country that has advanced, but not in the way you normally would advance. You know, there's things going on that seem to be kind of supernatural, and there's things going on that seem to be sort of in the horror genre, and then you still have technology. And so it makes, you really have to shift gears. It makes for a really, very challenging assignment for the artists. And I think that Giuseppe and the other artists that have helped him out so far have done a really great job. So I think it's a really good story. I don't feel like we've really gotten to the heart of the story yet, but again, they have to travel through all 13 zones or territories, and we're only on number 2. So we definitely have a long way to go. And it feels like it's kind of building up to a slow burn, but I'm really enjoying it so far. All right. Do you have any other books, Manny, or was that your last?
That was my last one. I was going to end it with the rant.
End it with the rant. Okay. Well, I'm going to go over, man, I have 7 other books that I can't talk about, but I'm just going to go over them super brief. The first one is Amazing Spider-Man number 51. This is written by Nick Spencer with art by Pat Gleason, colors by Edgar Delgado, letters by Joe Caramagna. I'll just say, so Ryan Stegman is off of Captain America, or Captain America. He's off of Amazing Spider-Man after a couple of years. He said it was a dream to draw, but he just wanted to move on and do other things, which is fine. The thing is, I was never a big fan of, I think I said Ryan Stegman. I meant Ryan Ottley. Man, it's late. Ryan Ottley is off of Amazing Spider-Man, said he wanted to move on and do other things after a couple of years, which is perfectly fine. I was never a big fan of his art on Spider-Man, so I was happy to see somebody else take over. But I don't know that Patrick Gleason is the right artist for this, at least not the style that he's using, because Patrick Gleason, he can use a lot of different styles. And, you know, I just talked about when I was talking about Department of Truth, how I like a really clean line. And I think that works really well for Spider-Man when you talk about guys like Todd McFarlane or Mark Bagley. And the style Patrick Gleason is using is sort of this hybrid where it seems like he's drawing Spider-Man himself with clean lines, but the rest of the book is a little, I don't know, aesthetically it's not quite working for me. And maybe it's because the villains he's drawing are demonic, and so it's not as clean, it's a little more sketchy. I'm not sure. So the jury is still out for me on how the art's going to work and if Gleason's going to stay on it for a while. As far as the story itself, you know, since this volume of Spider-Man started, 51 issues ago, it's been all about this villain, the Kindred. That's 50 issues, man. Like, he's been in the background and now he's in the forefront. I'm ready to read about something else. This feels dragged out to me at this point. You know, it's reminding me of Tom King's Batman, where it's overstaying its welcome. Like, I think Nick Spencer has a lot of great ideas, and he returned a lot of classic ideas and themes to Spider-Man with Pete, you know, struggling in his relationships and monetarily and such. And so that's felt nostalgic and kind of fun. But at this point, it's like, can we move on to something else besides the Kindred? I'm ready at this point. So, I mean, it's Spider-Man. I'm going to keep reading it, but it's definitely not blowing me away at this point. I'm ready to read about some, I mean, it's just this whole Kindred storyline is so morose, you know. It's Pete feeling guilty and ashamed and embarrassed. And it's like, enough already. I get enough of that, like in the regular news in 2020. I don't need it in my Spider-Man comic also. There's also a one-shot Black Widow, Widow's Sting by Ralph Macchio. There's a blast from the past. The art is by Simone Buonfantino. Colors by Rachel Rosenberg and letters by Travis Lanham. This is just a generic Black Widow one-shot. I'm sure timed to come out originally when the Black Widow movie was supposed to be on the big screen, because Black Widow in here kind of looks a little bit, way she's drawn, like Scarlett Johansson. So it's, if you're a Black Widow fan or a fan of Scarlett Johansson's portrayal of her in the movie, then I would say pick this up. You'll probably like it. But otherwise, it feels like generic comic book. There wasn't anything that really blew me away. The art is solid. The color work is solid. The scripting is a little hokey. It definitely feels like an 80s or 90s comic, which is when Ralph Macchio was sort of in his heyday in terms of the dialogue. So Dr. Doom, number 8 from Christopher Cantwell. The art is by Salvador LaRocca. Colors by Guru EFX. Letters by Corey Petit. One of the most beautiful comics on stands today. Salvador LaRocca, next level art in here. And I mentioned before how this kind of compares to the Batgirl 50, where it covers a lot of ground. This is kind of the same way. It's a lot of Doom narration or other character narration, and it covers a vast period of time from Doom regaining control of Latveria to him kind of cleaning up the mess of the attempted coup when he was removed from the throne, and sets up what has been teased by Christopher Cantwell previously about Doom being the savior of humanity. So it's kind of a catch up, I feel like, and a transitional issue to get to the next arc. If you're not reading Dr. Doom, man, Christopher Cantwell is making him as interesting as he's ever been. And I told that to Christopher last time I talked to him, because to me, Doom's always been kind of a mustache twirling villain. You know, he just wants to be bad for the sake of being bad. And, you know, he's smarter than everybody and puts everybody down because he's smarter, and he should rule the world because he's smarter, and he can't get over the fact that he's smarter than everybody else. And Christopher's really laying some nuance in here. And so it's, like I said, it's the most enjoyable I've ever found Dr. Doom to be as a character. Next up, I'll mention Fantastic Four Antithesis number 4. So this is by storytellers Mark Waid and Neil Adams. Adams handling the majority of the art duties, inks by Mark Farmer, colors by Laura Martin and Andrew Crosley, letters by Joe Caramagna. It's Mark Waid and Neil Adams. So I picked up the first issue and it was like, it was kind of a chore. It didn't feel special. The Adams art, you know, Neil Adams is a legend and rightly so, but you know, his skill level is not what it used to be, and it's through no fault of his own. And the art's not terrible by any stretch of the imagination, but I wasn't blown away by the first issue. But then we saw Silver Surfer show up on the last page, the final panel of the first issue. So I said, you know what, let me go ahead and give the second issue a read, because I do like Silver Surfer. And the second issue was quite a bit better than the first and had some interesting concepts. So it was enough to pull me back for issue 3. excuse me. And all I'll say about issue 3 is what happens on the last page of issue 3 is such a great idea and such a great curveball that I'm definitely reading issue 4. I mean, I've read the first three, might as well read issue 4. And based on issue 4, what happens, I might actually recommend this. Like, hey, if you're a Fantastic Four fan, pick this up. It's a good story. I was kind of disappointed after the first issue, because you hear Mark Waid and you think, oh, you expect it to be pretty good. But, you know, Neil Adams, as great of a penciler as he was in his heyday and as legendary as he is, He's never been the best storyteller. And I know he's done, you know, plenty of Batman stories on his own where he's both written and told the story, but they've never set the world on fire in their quality of writing. So if there's any shortcomings, you know, not to point the finger at Neil Adams, but you just, you know, wonder, this isn't a typical quality Mark Waid story, but he's not writing it on his own. But based on what happens here on the last page, and based on what might happen in issue 4, it may end up redeeming itself. So I'll definitely keep you all posted. We also have the latest issue of Immortal Hulk out today. It's issue number 39 from writer Al Ewing. Pencils by Joe Bennett. Inks by Bellardino Barabo and Ri Jose. Colors by Paul Mounts and letters by Corey Petit. One of the things, I was thinking about Immortal Hulk the other day, and here we are almost 40 issues in, and I have to say, it feels like we've only gotten about a year and a half of Immortal Hulk. I can't believe it's been 3.5 years that this book has been out. And part of it is because Joe Bennett's art is so spectacular and he uses so many big panels, and I wouldn't want to change that, but it just makes it where I feel like the narrative isn't advancing as fast as I would like it to. And so for that reason, I feel like it's kind of like The Walking Dead was back in the day, where you have to read it in chunks. Like, you know, I read last issue 38, I read 39. Previous to that, I had gone and done a big reread all the way of 1 through 36, and it feels really great. But when you read the individual issues, I almost feel like there's not quite enough story there, not quite enough happens to feel like, oh yeah, that was a great issue that I just read. When you look at it overall, I feel like it's something special, but when you focus in on one issue, sometimes it feels like it's kind of missing the mark, or maybe it's just not moving quite as fast as I would like it to. So still a gorgeous book to look at, but I don't know. It's, you know, I said this at the beginning of Immortal Hulk. It's a different take on the Hulk. It's not my favorite take on the Hulk. I like the Professor Hulk, where he's smart and he's heroic. And this certainly isn't that, but it's interesting and it's still good. I'm not trying to put it down at all. I'm just wondering if anybody else is getting a little fatigued of this kind of story and ready for the superhero Hulk to come back. Cause I definitely would welcome that. I also want to mention Shang-Chi number 2. This, I covered the first issue when it came out. This is by Jean Luen Yang. Art is by Dike Ruan, D-I-K-E-R-U-A-N. So I think it's Dike Ruan. Philip Tan does the flashbacks, Sebastian Cheng on colors, and Travis Lanham on letters. I didn't really care for the first issue. I just thought it was okay. But like I always say, got to give it at least 2 issues. Second issue is a lot better. I'm still done with Shang-Chi. I'm just not a big fan of martial arts and this type of story. But the second issue is way better. If you're a fan of Shang-Chi, you probably like the first issue. You're going to love the second issue. And it definitely sets up the story really well going forward. I'm just not that interested in the character. But the second issue does pull in some of his past and some of relationships from his past, and sets up some confrontations that are going to happen that are going to be really interesting. And there's more of his past to be explored and how it affects the story going forward as well. So again, if you're a big Shang-Chi fan from back in the day and you're familiar with the character, you're probably going to love it. It's just not that interesting to me. But I did feel like the second issue was a lot better than the first one. And the art by Ruan and Philip Tan is spectacular. Great color work, really great line work, lots of great martial arts action. So almost enough to pull me in. But I have nothing invested in the character, so I'm done with Shang-Chi for now. And the last book that I'll mention is Lazarus Risen from writer Greg Rucka, art by Michael Lark, colors by Santi Arcus, and letters by Simon Bolin. So this is continuing the Lazarus Risen quarterlies. It comes out, you know, 4 times a year now, and they're much bigger stories. It's basically, I think you get 80 pages a story. So it's almost like even one extra issue that you would get, because normally, you know, in 3 months you would get 60 pages. So you're getting a little more than that. Plus you're getting some back matter for the Lazarus RPG. And there's essays or letters, essays from Greg Rucka or letters from fans or what have you. So it's continuing the story of the Carlisle clan and their Lazarus Forever Carlisle, who basically is like this prototypical fighter and genetically engineered to be kind of the gladiator for her family. And in this dystopian future that she lives in, there are no more nations, there are no more countries or corporations. There's just families. Families run the businesses of the world and control the resources, and they basically own the land. And you're either a member of the family or you're a serf, you know, kind of like an indentured servant of the family, and you work for the family, and the family provides for your basic needs. So this story has been going on for years and years. There were 29, I think, individual monthly issues, and then it went to this new format of quarterly. And again, very prescient with what's going on in the world today. And when you talk about telling these type of stories, Rucka and Michael Lark are two of the best when it comes to the political aspects of the both the world and the political aspects of the families. So both the world they've created and the families that they've created to inhabit these worlds, the way members of the family backstab each other and double cross each other, the way the families interact amongst themselves, all that is handled very realistically in a very compelling way. So it has been and continues to be one of the best comic books out there. I don't think enough people talk about it. And part of that is the fact that they've gone to this quarterly format where they're only putting out four issues a year. So, all right, let me give a rundown on some of the other books that are coming out today, because believe it or not, we didn't talk about all of them, although I think we set a record talking about 19 books in one episode. So from Aftershock, I did mention that we had the Sympathy for No Devils, number one. If you're reading any of the AWA Studios books, that's Axel Alonso's new publisher, Old Haunts, number five, is out today. From Boom Studios, we've got the latest issue of Power Rangers Dracon, New Dawn, number three. We've also got Unkindness of Ravens, number two. That's Dan Panosian's book, as well as Wind, number five, from James Tynan, which finishes off that miniseries. Over at Dark Horse, we've got the latest Stranger Things comic, which is Stranger Things Science Camp, number two. And we've also got Colonel Weird's Cosmagogue, number one of four. And if you're not familiar with Colonel Weird, he's one of the characters from Jeff Lemire's Black Hammer universe. So that's a Jeff Lemire title. At DC, what didn't we talk about? Batman Beyond, number 48, is out today. John Constantine Hellblazer, number 11, is out. We also have Justice League Dark, number 27, Legion of Superheroes, number 10, and that's it. We talked about everything else. Over at IDW, in addition to Kanto and Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles The Last Ronin, we've also got G.I. Joe, number 9, as well as Star Trek Year 5, number 15. Over at Image, the final issue of Sex Criminals. And of course, they're ending with number 69. How appropriate. So that's ending this week. Also, Spawn from Todd McFarlane, number 311, is on stands today. Over at Marvel, in addition to the books we already mentioned, we've got Savage Avengers, number 13, Runaways, number 32, Strange Academy, number 4, Star Wars, Dr. Aphra, number 5, and the latest Ten of Swords tie-in, Ten of Swords Stasis, number 1. And lastly, I'll mention from Vault Comics, we have a couple of new number 1s, Autumnal, number 1, and Autumnal number 2, Autumnal number 1, if you missed it, second print, and Autumnal number 2 is out today, and then Giga number 1, which a lot of people have been talking about, but I haven't had the chance to check out myself. So those are some of the other books that are on stands today, and yeah, I think that's going to do it. We talked about a lot of books, but we still went shorter with two of us talking than I went last time talking on my own. You weren't here for that, Manny, but I think I was up till like 3 a.m.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, I didn't even start recording till almost midnight, and I talked for like 2 hours covering like 15 books. So really, really great week. There were a lot of really good books out there.
Lots of money.
Do you have a book of the week?
Do I have a book of the week? You know what? I think I do. Let me just take a look. You know what? Just because it's been a solid run and I'm very satisfied with all of it, I'm going to give my book of the week to Red Hood Outlaw 50. Just as an overall pick, just because of how it ties everything neatly with the bow, and it lets us move on now to something else. But a close second, I will say, is also going to be Batgirl 50, just because I think that the characterization of Barbara Gordon in that book is spot on to what it should be in 2020.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I gave Batgirl 50 some consideration. I gave Doom number 8 some consideration. They're both really good. I think the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle Last Ronin is really good. Mm-hmm. But there was one book that made me exclaim out loud when I was reading it because I was so surprised. And it was I'm giving mine to Rise of the New God. It was just based on that one moment. It just surprised me so much. And the artwork is absolutely spectacular. So I'm going with Rise of the New God as my book of the week. It was just such a cool moment. If you're not reading Dark Knight Death Metal and you have no plans of picking it up, pick up the issue and flip through it. And when you get to that page where the Chronicler is holding that skull, just, you know, take a moment to enjoy that wonderful art and then turn the page and you'll see which character it is, because I don't want to spoil. So. All right. I think that's going to do it for us. We want to thank everybody for listening as always, and we'll talk to you next time.
You can find the Comic Source Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whichever podcasting app you prefer. Please tell all your friends about us, subscribe, and rate us. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.